Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Going in the masjid every day and looking at the corners, like we can see they were sitting there. It's hard.
It took a while to like comprehend what happened.
Kia ora, we're your hosts, Julie
and Sarait. We travelled around Aotearoa with our soundie Joey, meeting immigrant whānau, listening to stories and discovering what is said or not said between different generations.
These stories warmed our hearts and broke our hearts. And over this series, we invite you two to listen in on conversations with my immigrant parents. This episode features Tuba, her husband Habib, and their kids Fatima and Usman. They moved from Pakistan to Ototahi in 2007 and have lived there ever since.
Habib works for the Ministry of Ethnic Communities, and Tuba doesn't formally have a job, but as you'll hear in the podcast, she really has many jobs, and she fills so many roles that are vitally important to her community. Fatima is 16 and Usman is 15, but they are in the same year at high school. Content warning, this episode discusses the March 15th terror attacks.
Fatima, our daughter, she is the first child. She was born in 2005. She's 16 years old and then she's high school. She's very confident and always ready to help or assist in the community. She's doing lots of volunteer work. She can make friends very easily. Very confident and very smart, mashallah.
We never had any problem with her until today. Very good, yeah.
Usman, he's our baby. He was born in 2006. He's younger than Fatima, 1 year. He loves cricket. And he's very confident boy, mashallah.
He's very caring. But when I looked at him, his actions, his thing, he posed like he's not caring. He don't care. He's kind of the naughty one in the family. And the one thing I love about him, Fatima is like always home, school, work, homework, everything on time. Teacher loved it, everything. But school sent us an email one day that Usman is receiving an award for studies. And me and my wife were shocked, like, we ring school back, that you may have made a mistake. It will be Fatima. And they say, no, it's Usman.
Our mom's name is Rosina Shaheen, but everyone just calls her Tuba. And she's the type of person who always looks into helping other people. And she always puts other people before herself. And she's very friendly and talkative. And our dad's name is Habib Marut. And he's...
He's very tall.
He always wants to achieve his goals and do better. He won't like end. He won't start something and just finish it. He'll always try doing the best and he'll try achieving better than he did beforehand. I think they're really cute because they're always flirting with each other, even in public. And they're always supporting each other. And my mum always has my dad's back and my dad always has my mum's back. And they're always going to be there for each other, and it's so obvious. They literally come up to us and they tell us, oh, we like each other more than we like you. And so it's like they're really
supportive of each other and the whole family.
When we arrived, and we were lucky one, Tuba's sister was here and she sponsored us and she supported us, and we came here as a permanent resident in 2007. But when we came in and the honeymoon period finished, I applied for 70 different jobs. The worst one, which still hit me sometime, one of the supermarket trolley pusher job. I was rejected for that. Like a person of 6'4", well-built. And I was young in those days. Now I'm a little bit old. But they told me that I can't push trolley in a supermarket. And I'm not going to name that supermarket.
Why'd they tell you no?
I don't know. I don't know. But what happened there, I asked a couple of my friends. They take me to one of the Indian restaurants. They had a dishwasher job, having two master degrees and being a principal in Pakistan. And you come to New Zealand and you have to start as a dishwasher. That was a big change, basically. EP was the manager name. When he looked at me, I never saw that huge dishwasher in my life. And he looked at me and said, Habib, you never did a dishwashing. And I said, no. In that job, the only thing was the dishwasher and the sink was low. And I am a tall person. My back used to hurt a lot. I also started another job in the morning because that was the evening job. Still, whenever I see Ippy in a hotel, and I usually go to his hotel, he's still manager of some of the restaurant. He tell proudly to his people that he was one of the best dishwasher.
Like a lot of immigrant families trying to make a new start, Tuba and Habib had to move their family several times, living in many different houses around Christchurch.
Every time that we started from zero, and then we moved to Mayfair in Deansev, that was quite big, beautiful house. But the big problem was the train was passing by our house. And when the earthquake came in the, I think, 3 or 4 a.m., your dad was in the mosque and you were very young. So I thought maybe the train is entered in our house. I was very scared. But when we realized, no, it's earthquake, no train in our house. After that, we moved to Riccarton and we lived there 10 years in same house.
Christchurch become a ghost town after the earthquake. And there was nobody. Everybody was leaving and people left to Auckland and Wellington and Australia. Your mom loved Christchurch. So the doctor said, find a home that is near the busy people. And in the whole Christchurch, the only busy place at that time was the mall, the Riccarton Mall. So we just found that home, luckily, beside the mall. Yeah.
Then after 10 years, we moved to Ilam in 2020.
Yeah.
We lived there 1 year and 6 months. Then from there, last year in March, we moved in this house. It was a very big task. The bad thing about moving houses was the inspection. They were giving us the dirtiest house and then we were cleaning and making it like new. And after that, they were coming every after 3 months and taking photos. And even there was a one piece of grass growing and they were saying, oh, you need to mow this or like this. Never. Every inspection day, I was never at home. Your dad was taking off to stay home.
Yeah.
I hated this because we were keeping the house very clean and tidy. Everything was done. And when they were coming, taking photos or like this, so I didn't like that time, you know. Mm-hmm. But thank God in this house, we don't have to move.
I can remember the Riccarton home quite well.
Mm-hmm.
There was red bricks and there was a backyard. And the main thing I remember is that we were getting our backyard done. Mm-hmm. So it went from like grass, like orange concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, that's all I remember. And then Ilam home, that's like when I started helping moving. And then we were moving from the Ilam home to this home. That's when I was like, in my prime of moving, like I was lifting like heavy swings and like heavy containers and all that. And I got
tell the story of energy drink.
Ah, yeah. So me and dad, we would be moving after school until like 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock. And my dad would always stop at the Morehouse petrol pump to grab Red Bulls. And we'd always get a six pack of Red Bulls and we'd have three each, three on the way and then three on the way back. And yeah, it was just fun times. And then we'd always come home and sit down and be like, while sitting down.
So tired.
And, yeah.
I feel like this discussion that the family has about renting different houses and having to move so many times is very relatable and very common for a lot of migrant families.
Yeah, I definitely related to that. When I was growing up, my family moved quite a lot. I think I said to you that like every time we would get robbed and then my family would move, but I don't know if that even makes logical sense because it's not like, I don't know if people, you know, does that make sense
yeah,
to like
does,
move
because,
when you...
Yeah, because people come back and they will rob the same place twice.
Right. I think in my head I was like, they already robbed us once. You're not going to come back to the same house. But yeah, I definitely remember that being a thing. And I guess for immigrant families, it's hard to find that stability when you're trying to just set up and... That is part of the immigrant experiences. Like it's not just the move from a different country, but it's also the unsettling of each iteration of moving as well.
It's also moving into a different social class, like getting to the point where you can afford your own home and you have the stability that comes with that. A lot of people take many years to to work up to that.
Yeah, and I think it's like once you have moved up to those upper classes, upper middle class, it's really easy to quickly forget maybe how it was like when it was harder. Like our peers who are from immigrant backgrounds are of a certain class now, and even within immigrant communities here in Aotearoa, I think there are separations between class, and we forget that even if we may have come through those pathways, to acknowledge what those differences are. Or
it's easy to pull the ladder up after you.
Mm. Or surround yourself only with your class after a certain point.
Mm.
I think there are some divisions there.
I think there's generally lots of migrants who've been here for a long time who look down on ones who are fresher.
Mm.
I think it's interesting you saying that you forgot it till I brought it up too.
There's definitely conversations to be had around class and class divisions within immigrant communities that I don't think are talked about as much. Like I think, I just don't think class comes into the conversation as enough. Much as it should.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's inconvenient, isn't it, to be reminded.
Mm.
In this next part, the family thinks back to how they were affected when the 2011 Christchurch earthquake hit, an event which took the lives of 185 people.
I remember very well, oh my God, they were very scary.
What happened?
When the second earthquake came, you were at school and in year zero, and he was in kindy, and your dad was in Rolleston in corrections.
Dunedin.
He
was working. I was in Dunedin on that day.
Oh, he was in Dunedin.
Yeah.
It was moving very hard and our TV fell and it broke. I was trying to sit in a car and to go to pick you and Usman and my sister from uni. But my all neighbors, they were very good and they didn't let me sit in the car till the earth is stopped moving. When it stopped and I left to pick you up and the roads were full and I was like, you know, crying. And first I went to his kindy to pick him up. And then when I went to your school, there was a police lady. She was holding you in her lap and you were eating, I think, lollipop or chocolate. But after that, I didn't let you go anywhere for maybe 1 or 2 months because I was so scared not to let you go out of the house.
I remember for 2 months, Mom used to take sleeping pills, calm downs, place due to the panic attacks because of the earthquake. And at that time, there was no luxury of working from home. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, your mom have to wait in the car park for me so I finish my shift and then we come back home tomorrow and you guys sitting on the back of the car.
When the aftershocks were coming, we were putting the big pot on our head. If something fell down, so we have safe heads. And I was telling you, when the aftershocks or earthquake came and there is a tsunami, just climb up the cupboards and sit in the cupboards. It was quite scary.
Yeah.
So you guys don't remember that?
No.
I didn't.
Lucky you. What you heard from your friends? Anything you ever discuss in your friends?
No, we don't talk about that.
So what do you talk about?
Makeup.
What is the one thing that you talk with your Kiwi friends?
I don't have many Kiwi friends, but I don't have white friends. I only have Samoan and Afghan and Pakistani and Indian friends. I don't have any
But
white
you
friends.
Have but, hello, hi with everyone.
Yeah.
But not the friend but like
that. Why? May I ask why? Any reason?
Because I just don't like being friends with them in a nice way because they're really different and I don't bond with them as well as I bond with others. Like the people I'm friends with, they have like the same type of journey as me. We just bond better because we're similar. And if you compare me to a white person, we're not similar at all. I just wouldn't choose to be friends with a if there was a white person and if there was a person of color, I would choose to be friends with a person of color.
But then again, the question will come, why? No, not in a bad way, but in a good way. Is there any rationale in your mind that why you will do that?
I think I'm just biased, maybe.
I love the way Fatima says this. I love how explicit she is about it. I think if I had understood this when I was younger, it would have like changed quite a lot in my life.
In what way?
Like when I started having more friends that weren't white, I was so much more relaxed and I felt like life became easier and it was so comfortable to not have to explain things or to not have to choose not to explain something.
Mm.
You know, it just
oh, it just feels nice.
Yeah. Like how Fatima says, you just have had a similar journey. So there's like a shorthand in your experience.
Absolutely. Mm. And I just think it's refreshing to hear someone so young say this.
Yeah. Mm. I think I've said before that I do think generation by generation, that sort of identity trauma about race and ethnicity, like lessens a little bit, or you'd hope that it would.
Mm.
I see my brother, who is like almost 10 years younger than me, and I don't think he ever went through that same self-hating journey and worshipping whiteness or anything like that that I felt like I went through.
This is the first family we've had on the podcast who are based in Ōtautahi and who were there to experience the Christchurch earthquakes and, of course, the terrorist attack of March 15th.
Before 15 March, we didn't have like a Muslim committee in school, and now we've got a Muslim committee. We have like monthly Muslim meetings. Mm-hmm. We would like talk about how school's going for us as Muslims and like what we can improve on as Muslims, and like people have become more respective of religion.
I'm one of the leaders for the Muslim committee at school. Before the 15th of March, we didn't have anything like that. And I think the Muslims in Christchurch or New Zealand overall, they weren't known. They were in their own bubble and people didn't really know them as well. But like after the attacks, they realized there are Muslims in Christchurch. It's a large community and we need to like stand by them. And I think that overall, the Muslim community, it just became stronger. We weren't close. Everyone was segregated in the community. Pakistanis were with Pakistanis, Somalis were with Somalis, and Arabs were with Arabs. But after that, we all became kind of close. And I built so much more friendships after the attacks. In the whole world, the 15th of March attacks were talked about, and they became a strong discussion.
It took a while to, like, comprehend what happened. You know that, like, there was a shooting in the mosque. We'd, like, comprehend it. So to understand that 51 people died, like, you two were, like, out of the house a lot at, like, you know, funerals, supporting families with government agencies and all that. And, like, it was, like, a really independent time in the house.
So how you took on, like, suddenly one day you were at school and you heard that there's attack on mosque. How you guys felt?
Because, like, we were in maths in the library, period five on a Monday, on a Friday, sorry, and we're excited to go home and lockdown happens. We're in lockdown until 6 o'clock. Our teachers told us boys' high has gone into lockdown. 10 minutes later, girls' high. And then we're told that there's a shooter in Hagley. Like, you had that sense in the back of your mind. It's sitting there that my dad could get shot or could die, or my mum could get shot or could die. For some reason, I felt like that wouldn't happen because, like, it was subconscious. I was telling myself, no, that can't be the case.
Me, I started wearing the hijab after the 15th of March. I didn't wear it before. Mm. I feel like if 15th of March never happened, I don't think I would ever have started wearing the hijab because I would just be embarrassed to wear it. I wouldn't be proud to wear it. But after the 15th of March, it gave me like a sense like Muslims are really strong and we're strong people and there's no reason. We need to show other people how strong we are.
Like, it was the worst nightmare of our life, you know. I was on the corner of the mosque. I was going to the masjid, but there was no parking. And I left from there, and I was just right on the corner. And I think police... No, I received a text message that you can't pick the children. It was, I think, from the police. And then all the ambulance and... Police started coming and this, and I was receiving calls from everywhere. All of my friends that their husband is not answering the phone. And I says, maybe they might be praying or like this. This I received 5-6 calls. And then I called you, Habib, this one is not answering the phone. And my friends start calling me that there is a shooting in the masjid. I says, no, there is no shooting. Maybe 2-3 friends will be fighting or like this. But all of a sudden we start coming to know that he's died, this, so many people. And then I called my children that, where are you, this, they were in the library and there was all the lockdown in the country and they says you're not allowed to pick. And then you called me and you says, just go to home, police will message you, then you can pick the children. All of our friends, they started crying, like, maybe there is shooting and this. So it was like worst nightmare for us, very scary. Many of our friends, they were putting on stretcher and taking to the hospital, this. Like, it was very hard to watch them, and everyone was screaming or this, you know, hard. Sad. It's not the same. Mm-hmm. Like, every day we discuss them, every day we miss them. Mm-hmm. In every prayer, we miss them in the masjid. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to look at their young children and young wife, like some of them are 27, 28, they are very young. And their children, they are under 5, under 2. Even one of my friend, her daughter was only 5 days old. So it's hard. Even their life is not same as ever. We didn't lost, like, in our family. Thank God we are fine, but we can't see them. We knew them, like, 16, 17 years. Their children grew up in front of us. So it's very hard looking at them, and we sometimes even don't want to discuss about them. We don't want to feel their family cry again or like this, but it's very hard. Going in the masjid every day and looking at the corners, like, we can see they were sitting there. It's hard.
I think so much about how this podcast would just not be the same project if March 15th hadn't happened, if 51 people hadn't been killed by a white supremacist. Almost every family on the podcast is mentioned, even if we don't always leave it in. Every single family mentions it, at least in passing, usually more than in passing, because their lives have been directly affected in some way by it. I just don't think we can ever, like, go back to what we were before that. We have to keep talking about it. We have to keep remembering it. We need to address the reasons why somebody feels emboldened to take this kind of action. A lot of white supremacists took courage from his actions, and we need to keep addressing that. It just can't be something that is left behind. The last 3 series of this show would have been completely different if that hadn't happened.
As we mentioned earlier, Tuba does an immense amount of community work, often running from place to place to support Muslim women in particular. This is something that does worry the rest of her family sometimes, as Tuba suffers from quite a few health issues, including rheumatoid arthritis and diabetes. In this next part of the podcast, Tuba describes what it was like when her health issues first became a problem.
It started in 2012. My friend came to my home. She left and I was coming to lock the door, and I fell down and I fainted there. And then your dad was calling me. I didn't answer the phone, and he came to home and the door was open and I was on the floor. So he called the ambulance, and then they took me in the Christchurch Hospital, and I think I had a high temperature. They did all the tests and everything, and they came to know that I have a rheumatoid arthritis. And then they started giving me medication and the steroid injections. And if I don't get these injections, there is fluid all over my body, and like, I can't walk because it's so much painful, and like, there's so many things. But thank God, with the treatment and everything. Like, one thing I want to tell you both, I think you were 3 or 4 years old. He was 3 or you were 4. I came from hospital after they removed my lots of lipomas and cysts, and I came home. I went to bathroom and I fell down there and I collapsed, and you both came and you were saying, "Papa, Papa, Mama is dead." You both were saying it. Then your dad came and he says, "I told you not to go there," and I was unconscious, I couldn't hear him. Then again they called the ambulance and they took me to hospital like this, and you both were sitting there around me and calling your dad, dad, Mom is dead, she's passed away. That's why I'm keeping myself very busy. So I don't want to think in my brain that I am sick or I have these issues, health conditions. So I'm taking all the medication, injections, everything, and I am just keeping myself busy around the community. Like, there are many families whose children are going through a lot, like anxiety, stress, lots of trauma. They were very cheerful, very happy, full of life children. But after this incident, so they are like not the same children. Even the young children, they are growing up. After some years, they will come to ask their moms that where is our dad, still they are asking, they are questioning their mom, but they don't know because they are so young, but when they will grow up. So because of one racist person, he killed all 51 people and then injured more than 40. And what he got? He destroyed all the families. But after this, like, we are more stronger, more together, more helpful to each other. Families are trying to settle. They are trying to forget everything. But it's not easy to forget everything. It's very hard for them. The moms, like, who didn't knew how to pay bill, how to drive everything, now they are learning. So we need to be prepared for every worse or good, both situations. So we need to be strong so we can manage in these things if something happen.
So your mom will receive a call at the middle of night. She will wake me up that, hubby, we are going for a drive. I never ask her that question, that what are we doing? And then we will end up in one of the bereaved family or one of our friend home because that family or that girl or that woman can't cope it anymore. And we go there and we pick up or we sit with them, chat with them for half an hour. And that panic attack or anxiety attack they have, they relieve from there and they thanks us. But she become more busy. She's spending a lot of time with the families. But sometimes they want somebody that in front of them, they can cry, they can laugh. To build that relationship that the families trust her, even then in their very, very personal matters. Tuba and Habib, if I say, we become uncle and auntie in the last 3 years. from nowhere, it's just started and now we are uncle and auntie. This event changed my family. If I look it back, Fatma suddenly started wearing hijab from nowhere, which I wished she do, but I never enforced it. Tuba also changed a lot. She become a calmer person. She is not arguing anymore that much. She just let it go.
I think she's more confident.
She was always confident. don't tell me that. you become, you are out of your character. When you are angry, you are saying things. The first thing that kids and my say, what is that thing, kids?
Where is mama's medication?
Now, had you had medication in the morning? Because that's the first thing. Like, I feel it, and I don't know kids can say that, but I feel it having 15, 20 tablets every morning and then injections, and I'm the nurse.
I have 2 medical alert band, then 5 years, disabled parking card, everything. But I just don't want to think about these things. I am just healthy. I can walk better than thousands. So it's a blessing for me that have children's house, husband, roof on our head. Everything is a blessing. Yeah. So if we think about the blessings, we are good. If we think about the negative things, oh, I'm sick, this. So we can't cope with life, you know.
Do you know your mom once said she want to donate blood? and I said, look, I and the doctor will have no issue with you in giving blood, donating blood. But we are thinking about that poor person who will receive that blood, all these steroids and everything. And next day you will be standing in front of hospital. I want the same blood you gave me yesterday.
Full of energy.
Full of energy and everything.
Do you think if you didn't have your medical issues, would you be more active in the community?
Yes, of course. So when it's time to take the injection or this, my all energy is gone. But after getting the injections, I am more energetic.
The one thing I'm telling you, Tuba, it is totally okay to assist and help other people. And this is because we are human beings and it is in our faith. But one thing is, I always told you that when you are assisting somebody, when you know somebody's story, somehow you are going through the same pain as they are going through. Again and again, I'm telling you, slow down. It's not that I want you to spend more time at home with kids. Kids are grown up now, and I think so. They are well behaved and they are well kids. But the only thing is just only for you to understand that it is totally okay sometimes to slow down and to rest and to gather that energy. You have your own health issues. Alhamdulillah, we have no family problems. Sometimes listening to these stories and going through those pain, take your energy, take things.
For me, I think these kinds of volunteer work, doing something for someone is giving me more energy and peace of mind and heart that I have done something, may Allah accept everything. And this is something like make me more peaceful and I can sleep at night peacefully that thank God I have done something and may He accept everything.
I think that makes a lot of sense that sometimes when you are so focused on your own issues that that can bring you down. But if you can turn your attention to helping others and that is what lifts you up. So the reason that Tuba is so busy is I can see how that's a coping thing as well.
I also think that so many women do this.
Mm.
They just turn their energy outwards and they care for everyone around them. And it feeds them in some way, but also it can be to their own detriment.
Yeah.
I was listening to this and thinking about, like, the meaning of community and what we say when we refer to community and who that actually implicates. And I was talking to my friend Hannah about this the other day. Shout out, Mpawa. What Habib and Tuba do for their friends, like, someone calls them up in the middle of the night, they get up, no questions asked, they go to their house, they sit, they talk till things are calmer again. I just think that this is precisely what community is, and this is like the thing that keeps us going and that brings us happiness, like knowing that you can do that, you can call someone and they can do that for you.
Just showing up.
Yeah. And they might not be in your direct family, but they know what you're going through, they understand it, and they want to be there for you.
Only recently, Fatima experienced another Islamophobic attack outside Al Noor Mosque.
Yeah, 2 years maybe after the shooting, and me and Mama, we were like, so we were taking like clothes from the masjid to put in the clothing bin. I was by the car, like I was going to the car, and I opened the boot. There was a lot of traffic. This car like stopped and there's like these two guys in it and
the guy from passenger's side, he started abusing and this and there was a brother inside the masjid and that racist brother said that your women have no power, they are
oppressed.
Yes, and they have no right, this. He was abusing and like he was behaving very bad, so that brother says that please go inside the masjid. She came and she says, Mama, there is a person who is abusing and like he was behaving very bad. Like we sat inside the masjid and then I called my husband. I talked to you that do you want to complain or like this? So you said, yes, I want to go. You talked with the police. We were in the masjid at that time. And then I think next day they caught him. And then thank God you were not scared. And like if you were quiet at that time and the whole life you will be scared or like this. But you took the step to go against this thing.
I didn't really think anything of it because I think society that we live in, I think it kind of enforces on us that it's normal for us to get treated like this. And it's not something odd, so I didn't think it was anything odd. Especially since it was after, like, the March attack. It was kind of normal at that point, I think.
Do you think it's normal?
No, we are taught to think that it's normal, but it's not.
How do you say you are taught to? Who taught you this?
The society that we live in. The internet and TikTok and stuff, it's all of the attacks and stuff. When it's a Muslim person who attacks someone, he's a terrorist and everyone is talking about it. But when it's a shooting in America or it's a white person, it's, oh yeah, like white supremacist, he's mentally ill. They don't make a big deal out of it because it's racism, it is everywhere. So you just naturally are brought up to think that it's normal. Many people say it as a joke, like at school, they obviously make jokes about 9/11 and Osama bin Laden and stuff like that. They find out we're Muslim, they're like, oh, are you related to Osama bin Laden and stuff like that? And we just kind of laugh it off. We don't take it as serious because they're joking. And even them, they don't have the correct knowledge to know that it's not okay because they're also brought up in a way where they think joking like this is okay. They don't know that it's actually wrong. So overall, everyone is just brought up to think that discrimination against us is normal, but it's not.
Let's say if the guy who racially abused Fatima, verbally racially abused, was like a white guy, all right? Mm. If I was in Fatma's position, I feel like he wouldn't say that to me because I feel like I could back my word and be like, oh, why'd you say that? And I could confront him because like men in society typically look stronger. Mm. I feel like one of the main reasons is he did that is because he knew that he thought that she's a woman.
This is an interesting one now. So you think that even then, forget about the ethnic parents now, you think that the in New Zealand, the Pakeha community or the European culture also think the same, that woman is easy, they will take on whatever we tell them or whatever we say to them.
Yeah, because like even in school, there's like there's only like some girls who back the word in a sense. Like as a guy, right, like it's easy like stand up to a male teacher and be like, oh, you can't say this to me. Because like you're probably bigger than the teacher or same height as the teacher. Like you can confront the teacher and size the teacher up. But like for like girls, the teacher like...
I disagree because if you look at Mama and Baba, I think Mama is more stronger.
I don't think
that. Wow.
I don't think that. That is so harsh.
And always, I always tell you and your dad as well that doesn't matter how tall, how stronger you are, just respect the teacher.
Somehow is Fatma said strong. For me, and everybody has their own perspective, but for me, strong doesn't mean that I'm well-built and I'm tall. Mm. Strong means that sometimes I may broke down, but Tuba... may stand that position.
I feel like being physically strong doesn't mean anything. No, you have to be mentally strong.
It means a lot, but...
No,
but
I don't think it does. It has some impact. If you're physically strong, but you're nervous of a cat, what are you going to do? Like, you can't just run away from a cat.
When we can kill someone with our words, there is no need to push or punch.
If you're 6 foot and you're scared of a butterfly, where are you going to go, Osman? Where are you going to run to?
No,
but if you're mentally strong and you're not scared of it, then even if you're 1 foot, even if you're like... Short.
Okay, so you're saying, so if you're mentally strong, if I'm 5'2" and I'm mentally strong and I go into a boxing ring with Mike Tyson, is my mentality going to work?
Boxing is physical.
Just run from there.
Run in a boxing match.
No, but first thing is...
Boxing is physical.
No, it's not an argument. It's a discussion like that. But first thing is, if you are... not mentally strong, you're physically strong, you will not have a courage to go to that boxing.
Yeah. No, you need muscular strength. I mean, it's not mental strength, it's mental endurance.
It's both.
Like you need to be able to endure and like logical thinking. Like you can't be 6 foot tall and not be able to like tell a right from a wrong. Or you can't be 5 foot and then be like, oh, I could beat you in a fight because I'm mentally stronger than you.
I don't know. Yeah. I just said, matlab, I don't think being physically strong means anything. Matlab, yani, like if you can stand up for yourself, like it just comes. You don't need to explain it. You just know when you're strong. No, and you can just tell other people. Like, okay, if I look at Mama and if I look at you, when you're driving, Hannah. You're really, just let me finish, okay? You're really road raged. So matlab, you can't control yourself and you just start being aggressive and you start doing the horn and you start, you know, being road raging, right? Mm. That's not strong, in my opinion. That's weak, in my opinion, because you can't control your body. But Mama, when something happens, she controls it. She just doesn't do anything. She has patience and she has sabr. Like, she has resilience. Mm. And I think being strong means you have resilience, commitment, and you're striving for the best. Mm. Like, for example, up, even if, like, a car was just turning, you'd be like, oh, my God, no, I need to go first. Mm. But then Mama, she has, like, patience. She would let all the cars go, and then she would go.
That's why I always say, your dad is not driving a car, he is riding a horse.
I think it's my favourite part of the episode where Fatima just says, actually, I disagree. If you look at mum and dad, like, I disagree.
I love Fatima's definition of strength.
I feel like while we were there, we could really see Fatima, like, taking after her mum, starting to go with mum to community visits that her mum does, and you can really see how she's learnt so much from her mum. And she just has learnt to view strength in a different, beautiful way.
Yeah, that's a really nice thing that she's taken from her mum, that she looks to her and she thinks, that is what strength is to me, exactly how my mum lives her life.
Mm.
What a dream. I think that the kind of strength that Fatima admires is the sort of strength that might be more of like a matriarchal idea of strength. And maybe Usman is...
stuck in a more
patriarchal
lens. Or
yeah, he perceives that physical strength as the one that he should aspire to and the one that's going to overcome, you know, everything. And it is just two different ways of looking at what tools we need to survive.
New Zealand and Christchurch is home, the community around us, particularly you guys around me and then our extended friends. That is home for me. This place where we are sitting today is the place of the center of all this big home. But as a human beings, we gifted with this earth. So ultimately, this our whole earth. But if somewhere I can call home nowadays, it is Christchurch, New Zealand, for now.
My home is where my both children and my husband is. This is my paradise inside this room. This is my home. Doesn't matter wherever we are in the world or wherever we are. When you, Usman, Habib, they are with me, I'm happy everywhere.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, matlab, wherever my family is, that's where my home is.
I feel like my home is wherever you feel safe or where I'm comfortable. Like if I'm comfortable at school or near cricket nets, like that could be my home. Like I don't have one set home. My home, it could be multiple places, like my bed, this house physically, and then mentally it could be like on my game. That could be like my happy place. But yeah, I've got a lot of homes, but I like this one.
So we wanted to say a big thank you to the family for having us, and a special thank you to Tuba and to Tuba's friends for letting us join them and sit with them on the second day of our recording.
Yeah, it was really special to be able to meet some of the people whose families were immediately affected by the events of March 15th, and we know that that still has a huge everyday impact on their lives. No tātou Aotearoa te whiwhi, tikite e te aumangia me te manawa roa o te hapori muhirama e mihi kauana ki te whānau.
You can check out photos and videos of all our families on Facebook at Where Are You From Really, on Instagram at Convos With My, online at tahi.fm or rnz.co.nz/conversations, or follow the podcast on all major podcast providers. Conversations with My Immigrant Parents was created, produced and directed by Julie Tull and Sarai De Silva. If you wish, you can follow us at Sarai De Silva or at Julie Tull with two U's. Location recording by Joey Siasoko. Sound post-production by Emmy Pagoni. Music composed and produced by Tal, Shantani and Shalina Sandran. And videos are edited by Josh Yong.
Our cover image is illustrated by Ngā Mutani Jones and designed by Sonia Milford. A big mihi also to Tim Burnell and Jody Huani from RNZ Commissioning. Conversations with My Immigrant Parents was made possible with the support of New Zealand On Air. He kōnei ipurangi tēnei mā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.